Good afternoon. So last time we talked about before the exam, which you may remember was a time, we talked about pipelining. The idea that we take our circuit, divide it into these stages, and we have this sort of assembly line of stages. That we do something part of the work in each stage, we store the results of that work in a register to hold the values, so in the next cycle we can be computing a different result while doing the next part of the work on that prior result. So we had things go through the pipeline, one stage to the next, and when that thing was in the next stage, the original stage was doing a new computation for a new instruction, a new operation to perform. We need registers to hold the values while the stages did the work, even though the prior stage would be computing something completely different. On rising edge, we'd advance everything forward one step in our pipeline. And we saw that, well, as long as we can keep splitting up the circuit, we got some speed up, but we had these diminishing returns, that registers aren't free, that they take some amount of time, that they need to read in the value and start outputting a new value every time we have that rising edge of the clock. And the minimum time we could set for the stage was based on how long the computation took plus that register delay. That determined our cycle time, which meant that eventually we were constrained by how fast the registers were and how quick we could make each stage be, and therefore how much throughput we could get. And we were working on this idea, seeing this trade-off here, where I divided up our add circuit into pieces, and we learned that each of these pieces, we took 35 picoseconds to do a piece, register delay plus the computation, and we could make this smaller and smaller maybe, but as we did that, we'd end up having that 10 picosecond for the register delay. We'd never get rid of it. We have to store the results, move them on, and that it would eventually dominate our time. And it's a bit worse than that. So this picture I showed you last time has this idea that we're going to take our adder, we're going to split it in half. That half of our adder is going to be doing the first half of the add, the other half's going to be doing the second half, and when we do that, we're going to end up with two equal halves that both take 25 picoseconds. Well, probably, we don't actually talk much about how adders work, but probably that's not what happens. We can't find a place to divide up our adder where things quite get nicely evenly divided exactly in half, and you end up doing something a bit less perfect. Like we end up dividing it into a 30 picosecond part and a 20 picosecond part. So we find a dividing line somewhere, but it turns out that the dividing line isn't exactly in half. And this is gonna hurt us when we try to do pipelining. So previously, back here, it took 35 picoseconds per stage, which means we had one operation every 35 picoseconds, which gave us that 1/35 ops a picosecond throughput. What's it gonna be with this change? Now that we learned that, sorry, you can't split up your adder exactly in half. What's our throughput now? How many times three operations do we do per picosecond? Any answers? Okay. 1/40. So how did you get 1/40? So it's one op for 30 picoseconds plus a 10 picosecond delay. So we're saying that we need to wait for this to happen for every operation we do. And even though we might say, well, next to that we have this thing which is, this is 30 picoseconds in total versus our 40 picoseconds here. Well, it doesn't matter that that takes only 30 picoseconds because we can't feed it values faster than 1/40 picoseconds. Similarly, you might say, well, this here, this is 35 picoseconds, but that also doesn't matter. Yes, we could run, get a value every 35 picoseconds there, but we can only feed it to the next stage every 40 picoseconds because the stage won't be finished with the prior thing we gave it. We still have to wait 40 picoseconds. So the general rule is that we're going to have to wait for the slowest stage. That's going to determine how short we can set our clock cycle. So we'll set our clock cycle so the slowest stage works, and that means that that's going to determine our overall throughput. All the other stages, doesn't matter if they could be faster, they're not going to be. We're going to have to wait because we can't get values fast enough if they're after the slowest stage, and we can't send values fast enough if they're before the slowest stage, so everything goes the speed of the slowest stage. And when we talk about our returns from splitting up our circuit into pipeline stages, this is going to hurt us in addition to the register delay. That we start out with 100 picoseconds of logic, and when we divide it up, we'll often find that, well, there's not exactly a divided in half line, so we'll end up with, say, one 60 picosecond part and one 45 picosecond part. So here I'm saying that not only did we not divide it in half, but there's like 5 picoseconds of stuff that was done kind of in parallel before that we've now like moved ahead. So we've made the total computation time a little longer because we didn't manage to find exactly where to divide things up. So that we didn't have, you know, where previously these two things overlapped, now they don't. So we spend a little extra time because of that. In addition to that it being uneven. So here we need 70 picoseconds because we need the 60 picoseconds of logic and 10 picoseconds of register delay. And it doesn't matter that the second stage is faster. It doesn't help us. We can't give it values fast enough. So we get these diminishing returns, not only from our register delay, but from the increasing difficulty of splitting things up evenly. No, we're not going to do that, so we're going to have a little bit of imperfection. It's still worth it. We still saved time per cycle, which means we'll have a better throughput. It's just not nearly as better as we like. We didn't get twice as fast with two stages. We got faster, significantly faster, but not even close to twice as fast. So any questions about this idea of these diminishing returns from not being able to split things evenly? So that's our sort of conceptual idea of pipelining. So let's talk about applying it to our books processor. And the thing about our books stages that when we talked about our single cycle processor, I mentioned that these were entirely conceptual. That these writes all really happen at the same time. They're all triggered by the rising edge of the clock. And these reads, when they happen, it's not based on the order I listed here, it's based on how things are wired up. That might happen to be with this order, it might not, depending on when values are available. So we're going to turn these into pipeline stages. So that's the other reason we have stages besides helping you organize your processor, is that these are going to be our pipeline stages, almost. So we're going to make a little change. So here are our pipeline stages. And I moved one stage into another. So previously at the end, we had PC update. We're gonna move it and combine it with the fetch stage. So we're gonna have a fetch and PC update. We're gonna read the instruction memory and compute the next PC. The reason we're gonna do that is because, well, we want something to do in the fetch stage in the next cycle. And to know what to do in the fetch stage in the next cycle, we need to know where do we read the instruction memory. And we need to get that from looking at the last instruction, how big it is. Or what kind of instruction it is. And if it's a call, we need to know the address. So we want that information for the next cycle. So we're not willing to wait until a bunch of stages have passed to get it. We're going to make sure it happens in the fetch stage as soon as possible, even though that's going to make it harder to make our fetch stage. Just so we always have work to do in our pipeline. Otherwise, we have to wait 6 cycles to get the next thing to do. That's not going to make any sense. It's going to make our pipeline processor not have good throughput. We're just going to be waiting all the time. So something you might notice if you're thinking carefully about this is, okay, so we compute the next PC, and if you think about, okay, how do we compute the PC? So usually we add the instruction length. Well, we can do that with the, just read the instruction memory, figure out what instruction type it is, read the length. There's some cases which don't work so well, like conditional jumps. What do we need for that? Something with ELU maybe, that might be, we might not be able to do that. And say, what about return? We kind of need a value from memory. How do we do that? We'll solve that problem later, but it is a problem. Wait, this doesn't let us handle all instructions yet. We'll figure out how we deal with the cases where you're like, we can't compute the PC, we don't know, the stuff we need is in a later stage. We'll figure that out later. But it is a problem that we'll have to deal with. So now that we have these stages, let's look at how this applies to a simplified example. So I'm going to do a processor which only executes ads. So here's my processor that only executes ads. So it's, I take my PC value. To compute the next PC, I always add 2 because I only care about ads, and I'm going to use the actual YAD6 instruction format. I put that PC in the instruction memory, I get out my register numbers, I read 2 registers, add them together, my ALU is just set to always add, I don't have a memory over here because I never access memory. I put that into the register file and also write out, put in the correct register number to write to. So this is my only ads processor. And as a first step to making a Python processor is I'm going to mark all the stages. So here are all my stages. So I have my fetch and PC update, my decode, my execute, and my write back. And basically what we're going to do, like we did for the x3 circuit, is we're just going to draw lines between the stages, and everything that crosses those lines, we're going to put a pipeline register there. Because we're going to pass values from one stage to the next, from fetch and PC update to decode, from decode to execute, from execute to write back. But there's a bit of a problem we have when we just draw lines and put registers there. Anyone see it? Some place where we're not following that rule of passing one stage to the next. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if we just decide, okay, I'm going to draw a line here, and a line here, and a line here, we have this problem that I'm taking the register number that corresponds to the instruction in decode and using it with a value for whatever instruction made it 2 more stages on with write back. So I'm going to be writing to a different instruction's register number than the value I've computed comes from. So I'm going to compute the value for one instruction and write it to the register number specified by the instruction 2 instructions later in the program. And that's not good. We want to actually execute the instructions that are written, not some weird agglomeration combining 2 different instructions that happen to be close in the program. So to deal with this, we're going to follow this rule that our signals are going to go from one stage to the next, and so on. We're never going to have them skip stages. And to do that, I'm just going to redraw that wire. The same circuit, I just made a much more convoluted way of drawing my destination register number so it goes through each stage. And now when I do this, I can draw my, here's where I'm going to put some registers, here's where I'm going to put some registers, here's where I'm going to put some registers. Just, I'm drawing a line separating each of the pairs of stages. So I'm saying I'm going to put them between fetch and decode, between decode and execute, between execute and write back, because I want the fetch stage to continue work on the next instruction. While the decode stage works on what just fetched, I need registers to store those values. And the same thing between decode and execute. So I'm going to add registers across everything that crosses that line. So there we go. So I add those registers, and now I have my pipeline processor. So any questions about how we got this processor here? Chose what my stages were, made sure my signals went from one stage to the next, and just added registers, everything that goes between stages. So I'm going to sometimes need to refer to these registers. I'll usually refer to them by the names of the two stages they connect. So we have fetch to decode, decode to execute, execute to write back. And we have a bank of registers. This is why our HCLRS lets us declare multiple registers together. That's precisely to support this use case. We also have another pseudo pipeline register, which is the PC. And you can think of the PC as being a fetch-to-fetch register. Now we're communicating from one fetch stage to the next one about what to do. And this violates our one stage to the next rule because this is a case where we want to send information from one instruction to another one. Whereas all the other cases, we're sending the same instruction, just passing it on so it goes from one stage to the next. Here, it's different instructions communicating with each other about what to do. We learn from the prior instruction what the next instruction to run is. Okay, so let's go through what it looks like executing this simple program here. So we're adding R8 and R9, then we're adding R10 and R11. These are our two instructions, and let's walk through how they go through this pipeline. So first, we have our PC outputting here the address of instruction 1, which goes into the instruction memory, and we get the add queue instruction, and we extract the register numbers 8 and 9 from that. And at the same time that this is happening, we add 2 and compute the address of 2. So this means that our PC as input has the address of instruction 2, and these two fetch to decode registers have register numbers 8 and 9 on them. So that means at the rising edge of the clock, they're going to all those registers are going to store their inputs. So we'll move on. And now we have our PC outputting the address of instruction 2, and we have our fetch to decode registers outputting register numbers 8 and 9. And since these are outputting 8 and 9, that means we're going to copy 9 to this register here, and we're going to get the value of R8 and the value of R9 as input to the other decode execute registers. And at the same time, we're going to be executing part of instruction 2. So instruction 2, we haven't started decoding it yet, but we read it from the instruction memory. We get 10 and 11, so we'll store its register numbers, so we'll read them from the register file in the following cycle. So in the next cycle, we're reading from registers 10 and 11, while we're actually adding the values of our 8 and the value of our 9 and passing on the register number 9. So we set up for a write back. So in the next cycle, we'll end up storing our 8 plus our 9 in register 9 while we're adding the value of our 10 and our 11. That's what we're setting up because our inputs to our decode to execute registers will be the value of R10 and the value of R11, while the inputs to the execute to write back registers will be the sum of R8 and R9 and 9 and register number 9, which is what we'll write back. So any questions on how things go through the pipeline? So note that their general pattern is that the first instruction goes through and the other one just follows immediately behind it, separated by one set of pipeline registers. So another way of visualizing what goes on is I'm going to give you a table here of the values in the pipeline registers. So in cycle 0, we're outputting the address of add R8 or 9 from the PC, and so that means we're inputting into our pipeline registers the values 8 and 9, which means during the next cycle, we're going to have 8 and 9 being output from the fetch to the code registers, while our PC, instead of outputting 0, outputs the added 2 value, which is 2. And eventually, during cycle 3, we're going to have the PC for this last instruction, add R9, R8, and we're going to have the register numbers for the instruction before that and the fetch to decode registers, while the decode to execute registers have the values for the instruction before that, while the execute to write back registers have the value to write back for the instruction before that, our first instruction on our list. And each instruction you see goes through one step from one set of pipeline registers to the next each cycle. So, any questions on this? Yes. The question is, how would you do this in HCLRS? We will get to that. Okay, so let's first talk about the performance of this. So how much faster is it actually? And to do this, we have to talk about, well, how fast was it beforehand? So first I want to say, let's say I didn't do the pipelining yet. How fast would it be? Well, to know that, you need to know how fast are each of the components of the processor. Like, you know, if I don't tell you how fast my adder is, how could you possibly know how fast my processor is? So I'm going to tell you here that this add2 here takes 80 picoseconds, the instruction memory takes 200, the register file read takes 125, and the add takes 100 picoseconds, and the register file write takes 125 picoseconds, meaning that we like need to give the inputs 125 picoseconds before the rising edge of the clock. So I got from this a time of 550 picoseconds for our add queue processor, which I did by saying I'm going to add up, so R1, our instruction memory, our register file, our add queue, and our register file write. So this is the numbers I added up and got 550 picoseconds there. So why did I exclude the add2? Why am I not adding that up to compute how long things should take? Yeah, so that's add queue. Our timeline is going to look, we have our rising edge of the clock, and we do our instruction memory access, we do our register file read, we do our add, we do our register file write, and while we're doing this instruction memory access, we also do the add2. That those can both happen at the same time, and they will. So what matters is what we call the critical path. We mean the slowest way of getting from one register or memory to another. And that's going to be going from our PC, through our instruction memory, through our register file, through our adder, through, and to the register file again for the write. That's the slowest path. It's not the only path through the circuit. So like, we also have a path which goes from our instruction memory and goes around and skips the adder and goes to the register file. But that doesn't matter because that's faster than the slowest path. And that will happen in parallel. Of course, we can pass on the value while we're also adding. It doesn't add any time. We don't add up all the paths. And for the same reason, we can do the add2 while we're doing the instruction memory read. It's not going to increase the total time. So all that matters is the slowest path. And we're going to use the same principle to figure out how much time things take for pipelining. So for pipelining, I'm going to say, well, I have a fetch stage here. So this is my fetch. This is in my decode. This is in my execute. This is my write back. And I'm just looking at, well, what's the time for the longest path in each of these stages? So in our fetch stage, we have this path which takes 80 picoseconds. We have this path which takes 200 picoseconds. So the 200 one is the time, minimum time we need for the fetch stage. For our register file read stage, we have this path which takes 0 picoseconds. And this path, which takes 125, so we have 0 picoseconds or 125. Well, 125 is slowest. That's how long we're going to need for that stage. And we do the same for execute. We have this path, which takes 0 picoseconds, and this one, which takes 100. So we're going to need 100 picoseconds. The register file write, we're going to need 125. And the time that matters is the slowest stage, because everything needs to wait for the slowest stage. In this case, it's the fetch stage because of that instruction memory. And it's only the instruction memory because, yes, the fetch stage also adds 2, but that happens at the same time we access the instruction memory. It doesn't increase the amount of time even more. We only pay for the thing that's slowest. So we have our slowest path through stage is 200 picoseconds. And we also have the register delays, which I don't have written down, but after every stage or before every stage, we need to wait for the register delay, and that's going to add to our cycle time. So for example, we have a 10 picosecond register delay, then the minimum we can set our clock cycle, the minimum time between rising edges of the clock is going to be 210 picoseconds. So this means that we'll finish one instruction, in that case, every 210 picoseconds. And if we're looking at how long does it take an instruction to go from the beginning to the end, that's going to be 210 times 4 picoseconds because it has to go through all 4 stages to finish. Any questions about this timing? So how we figure out how long things take, how short we can set our clock cycle with a single cycle processor or a pipeline processor, given that we know what the components we're using are and how fast they are. Okay. So that's performance. Now we're going to get to sort of the issue of how do we do this in HCLRS. And first I'm going to talk about a naming convention. So this is a naming convention that our textbook uses, which I'm going to explain because the textbook is really handy for the stuff if you can actually read it. And also because you'll probably end up using this when you're coding pipeline processors in HCL. So the convention is that the input to a pipeline register is going to be named after starting with the lowercase letter of the stage it's from. So the inputs from fetch, named with a lowercase f. The inputs from execute are named with a lowercase e. The inputs from decode are named with a lowercase d. And the outputs to a stage are named with a capital letter of that stage. So the input to decode is named with a capital D. The input to execute is named with a capital E. The input to write back is named with a capital W. So this means that when you're working within a stage, everything you're dealing with that's not a built-in component starts with the letter of the stage. So in the decode stage, you're dealing with lots of signals that start with a uppercase D, which are your inputs, and start with a lowercase d, which are your outputs to the next stage. So this is the convention our book follows. So this is what, big D of RA means input to decode that's called RA, which comes from little f of RA because that's the previous stage and the little letters are for the outputs of a stage that go to the next stage. And this, you'll notice, fits with what HCL supports for registers, that we're going to do something like register FD, and that will give us exactly these names. an FD for fetch to decode. So any questions about this naming? So in HCL, if we're writing out the add queue processor, it's going to look something like this. We'll declare each of our registers with that syntax, so FD for fetch to decode. And we'll assign, when we're implementing the fetch stage, we'll assign the values of the output of the fetch stage. The same thing we're implementing the decode stage. So the decode has a DESD output. We're going to assign that based on its input. It has a valet output. We're going to assign that based on its input using the register file, which means we have to read from the register file, which means we need to use reg source A. That's how we come up with that code. And the general pattern you see here is that when I write the code for each stage, most of the work it's doing is reading from the registers that come before, writing to the registers that come after, and if we need to do something with like a register file or memory, we'll do it using the inputs and putting the result in one of its outputs that goes to another register. So any questions on this sort of code fragment? And so the transformation, if you like, wanted to take your unpipeline code and pipeline it, is that you're going to change cases where you'd output to sort of some global, and output to a pipeline register if it goes to another stage. And you're going to use inputs from other stages rather than global values. And in addition, set up all the registers based on the values you know need to be passed between stages. So something to note here is that I wrote reg none here. Why did I do that? So reg none is the constant 15. Why did I specify reg none as the default value of the fetch to decode registers? Yeah. Yeah, so before we run any instructions in fetch, there's going to be some values in the decode stage. And if we put the wrong values there, it's going to be passed on as DESD to the execute stage. And that's going to be passed on as DESD to the writeback stage. And two cycles later, we will be writing to a register some sort of value. We do not want to do that. We want, before we fetch the first instruction, everything the process fetch the first instruction and send that to writeback. We don't want anything to happen. The way we make sure nothing happens is we supply the register number 15. So when we try to write our result that we're computing with this bogus instruction that we start out with, nothing happens. And that's the purpose of doing that. And you'll notice I follow that convention throughout, that I supply this not do nothing values to make sure that when things start out, we don't start by writing to registers that we're not supposed to. So, any questions on this HCL? Okay. So, given that we know sort of this for add queue, we can apply the same principles to our overall pipeline processor. We just take our picture of a pipeline processor, we just mark the stages on it, and we're just going to draw lines between all the stages and add registers there. So is there anything we need to do first? Hint, it might be similar to what we need to do for the add processor. Anything before I start just saying, okay, I'm gonna draw some lines, here's a line, put registers, everything that crosses that line, also here, and so on. Anything I should do before I do that? Yeah. Yeah, so we still have our problem that we are passing values directly from fetch to writeback, and that's going to mean that if we don't do anything, we're going to end up writing back based on the wrong instruction. using register numbers from the wrong instruction, we're going to get the wrong answer. We don't want to do that. And the general rule is that we always, except for doing like jumps or something like that, or you know, figuring out what the PC is, we always send signals from one stage to the next one, never skipping a stage, or never going backwards. So we'll redraw this. And I've made a choice here that I'm going to compute the values of the destination in the decode stage, even though we don't need them yet. You don't have to do this, but it turns out that this will make things easier later on. We'll see why next Tuesday. But like with the add processor, after I compute that value, I'm just passing it all the way through all the other stages to write back. So it stays with the instruction it belongs with, because we want to make sure that whatever value we're passing to write is the same value that we get the register number to write to from. Okay. So we just take lines between all the stages, add pipeline registers. I've just drawn them as one big register, even though they're going to be a set of registers. Yes? Why did I move this mux here? So I made a decision that I didn't have to do, that I'm going to compute the destination register number into code rather than write back. You can make a correct processor where you compute it in write back, and that would be fine. It turns out that computing into code is going to make things a lot easier for us later on. And we'll see why on Tuesday, basically. So that's our dividing it up into a pipeline, and we need to have a bunch of control logic. So once we figure out how things are divided up into a pipeline, we just code up each stage independently, where we know what goes in pipeline registers, so we're just going to write code which reads values from those pipeline registers. You know, if you're into code, you get things from pipeline registers that tell you what to fetch, and sends input to the next stage, and the rule is that you always get your values from pipeline registers, send to the next stage, and you only interact with components that are in your stage or come from the pipeline, or values that come from the pipeline registers. You never share between instructions except if you deliberately mean to do so, like a conditional jump, probably there's some sharing going on. Like we're sending information from one instruction to another about whether to do the jump based on the condition goes. But if you aren't meaning to do that, you should only be using your pipeline registers, you know, the outputs you have from the prior stage, the inputs you have from the next stage, and any components that you are responsible for. Like if you're the memory stage, you interact with the data memory. If you're another stage, you should never touch a memory stage's wire, because that's not your job. If you want the memory stage to do something, you better use a pipeline register to tell it to do that. So let's talk a bit about control logic, keeping these rules in mind. So here, let's say I'm making my memory stage, and when you're doing your single cycle processor, we're going to have our data memory, and we have to figure out whether we read or write. So we set the read bit based on the I code. So we get the I code from the instruction memory, so we take I10 bytes, we extract 4 through 8 of it, we get the I code, we compare it to something, see if whether we're reading or not. So we end up with code which looks something like this. Okay. So we read I10 bytes, we compare it, say if it's an MRMove Q, we're reading, and a few other instructions. If not, we aren't. And that's what we do. Can we so what's the problem with just doing that for our pipeline processor? Yeah. Yeah, so the I code might have changed because it's going to be for whatever instructions in fetch. So we're in memory. So we're instruction one in memory. Instruction two is in execute. Instruction three is in decode. Instruction four is in fetch. And we're going to have the I code for instruction four, which is not going to tell us what we actually want to do with the memory. And the way we're going to solve this is that we're going to follow the rule we have here, that we read the prior stage's outputs. So we're going to have the prior stage tell us, via a pipeline register, what's the I code. Now, the execute stage, it doesn't have an instruction memory. And we've now said it needs to know what the I code is. So how is it going to find out? Well, it can't get it from the instruction memory, because that's going to be the I code for a different instruction. So it's going to get it from its pipeline registers between decode and execute, which means the decode stage needs to figure out the I code, and it's going to get it from its pipeline registers between fetch and decode, which finally can get it from the instruction memory. So we just pass the value on through all the stages until we need it. And this is the general rule. If you need a value that comes from a different stage, you're going to have to pass it through the pipeline registers every single step of the way to make sure you keep it with the same instruction. And so that gives us code something like this, that we're going to figure out the I code in our fetch stage. We're going to pass it to decode, pass it from decode to execute, from execute to memory, and finally we're going to get it out in the memory stage and be able to do our comparison. So, any questions about this logic? Yeah.
Not a question, but just kind of a, I guess it's a question. Is this similar to 4.41 in the textbook that we're talking through?
Is this similar to 4.41? I believe so.
The figure like that was on the quiz where they kind of drew out like, all these different. It was I think SQL plus or pipelines or something.
This is similar to one of the textbook's processors. So, yeah, this is what they do. The textbook has a lot of diagrams of the processor which omit control logic, which iCode is. So I'm not sure like specific diagrams actually show this. Okay, so that's our basic pipelining. So let's talk about a problem we have with what we've done so far. So here, I have my add queue processor, my nice pipelined add queue processor, and I'm executing add R8, R9, add R9, R8, and I'm saying initially R8 is 800, R9 is 900. So what this should do is we take R8 is 800 plus R9 is 900, gives us 1700. And then we read from R9, we should get 1700 plus R8, which is still 800, and we should get 2500. But if we actually execute this with our pipeline processor, well, first we read, in cycle one, we read 800 and 900. In cycle two, we read 900 and 800 because it's not until here, until after cycle three, that we actually write back the 1700 into R9. So we're reading it before we wrote it back. And this means that our pipeline processor, the natural pipeline processor we made, where we didn't do anything special, we just added the pipeline registers, set things up, doesn't work. And this is called a data hazard. So this is a case where we get the wrong value because our pipeline processor is doing things in a different order. Previously, we would wait for the value to be written back before we read it again. But that's not what's happening here. Here, we're not waiting for the value to be written back. We're reading it too early, so we have a problem. And so one way of looking at this, you know, that we're not reading 1700, and that's because we're not doing things in the order that our instruction set architecture specifies. Our instruction set architecture says, if you execute these instructions, you read R8 and R9, use that value to write R9. After you do that, then and only then you go on to the next instruction, and then you read R9 and R8, then you write R8. And what we're actually doing is reading R8 and R9, reading R9 and R8, then writing R9 based on the first set of values we read, then writing R8 based on the second set of values we read. So we're doing things in the wrong order, and often it doesn't matter. So like in our prior example, back here, it didn't matter. Like we didn't have any problems because we weren't accessing the same registers often enough. But now it does. So we're writing the wrong value because we're reading the wrong value. So this is known as a data hazard. It's the case where our pipeline just doesn't do the right thing because we're reading an old version of a value. And we're going to want to do something about this. It's not acceptable for our processor to give the wrong answer. So we need to fix this. And we're going to give you several solutions to this problem. We're going to have two today, and we're going to have one more on Tuesday, which is a lot better than those two, but doesn't work all the time. So I'm going to start with the simplest possible solution, and that's we're going to change the ISA. I'm going to say, well, gosh, I just specified the add instruction wrong. Why would I have specified an instruction that writes to a register immediately? That's really hard to implement. You know, better if I just said, yeah, so this add instruction, it takes two registers, it reads their values, and three set instructions later, it writes the result. That's what my specification of the add instruction is. I don't know why I was ever thinking I would specify an add instruction that wrote the value immediately. That's ridiculous. Now, that's going to be slow. So I'm just going to say it's a different instruction, and hey, assembly writers, compiler writers, you need to deal with it. So if you want to add our 8 and our 9, then add our 9 and our 8, and you want it to work the way you expect, you better add some knobs to make that work, or put some other instructions in there. Now, that's our solution. So I'll just fix the ISA to match what my processor does. Problem solved. Now, compiler writers, just deal with this. Yes, my add instruction's really weird. Sorry. And you might say, this is a completely unacceptable solution. No one would do this. But this kind of solution has been used by real processors. There have been real processors where they've just said, we're going to assume we're doing some pipelining, and some instructions are not going to take effect immediately. And that's precisely to enable this. This is a real solution you can use, but it's not very convenient because the compiler has to keep track of this, or if you're writing assembly by hand, you need to keep track of this and make sure you pay attention to what the instruction actually does, that takes some time to write its values out. But this suggests a solution that probably makes you, at least as a compiler writer, more comfortable, but it's going to be more work for us as a hardware designer. This is certainly easiest for the hardware designer. You just document what your pipeline processor does, all the horrible ways it is non-intuitive, and just say, deal with it. But, you know, if we want to be nice to the compiler writer, we want to have the same semantics. And we can just say, okay, we're going to do what the compiler should have done and insert some knobs. But we're going to have the hardware figure out, oh, you want to do add our 9 or 8, but I'm writing our 9. That means you're going to need to wait. So I'm going to figure that out for you. So I'm going to add some circuitry that figures out, oh, you're trying to read a register I haven't written yet. And I'm going to add the knobs for you. So I'm just going to insert some dummy knobs, and this is called stalling. So conceptually what we're doing is that we have our instruction memory, and it's outputting a value, and I just have a mux here where I put in a static copy of a knob, and sometimes I give you the knob instead of the instruction, and I have my PC which feeds the instruction memory, where sometimes I compute my next PC, but I also have an option of just keeping the PC the same until I'm done putting in knobs. And that's just, I have some extra logic there. That's the extra data path stuff, so I have a way of adding a knob instead of the instruction I actually read, and I have a way of keeping the PC the same until I can actually get around to not replacing an instruction with a knob and run it. And I just need some extra logic to detect, oh gosh, this instruction is not going to work, I need to wait. So this is called stalling. This is something we can implement in hardware, and now we have the same semantics. But we worry about, you know, how long our pipeline is, not the compiler writer. So what that ends up looking like, if we're taking the values in registers, something like this. So I fetch the first add instruction, we read R8 and R9 in the next cycle, and then I fetch add R9, R8, and we say, oh gosh, can't let this instruction go, it's not going to work, because I'm going to need to write the value it's trying to read first. So I keep the PC the same, and I replace that instruction, where I'm marking with a star, with a no-op. In this case, my no-op for an add is to add to register none, that is register 15, that will do nothing. So I just pass register 15 down the pipeline, saying, I don't really want you to add, I don't have work for you, and I keep the PC the same until I'm ready to let the instruction go through the pipeline, because I know it will read the value that was written by the previous instruction. So I have these two cycles where instead of actually letting the instruction go through, I put in nothing. This is called a pipeline bubble. So I put in my NOP in order to wait long enough so that when the instruction gets to the code, it will read the correct value. And with this, it's the case that at the end of cycle 3 here, I'm writing the value. And during cycle 4, I'm reading that value I just wrote, so things work out fine, and I couldn't have possibly stalled any less. So I needed to wait at least that long. And another way of visualizing this is we can say, instead of thinking about the values of the pipeline registers, we can say, what instruction is in what stage? So initially, we have our first add in the fetch stage, and it goes through the pipeline normally. It goes from fetch to the code to execute to write back. But for a second add, we keep it in the fetch stage until it's ready to go down the pipeline. And when we're keeping it in the fetch stage, something needs to happen in the code. We can't just say there's no values on the wires. There's going to be a value because it's a wire. It has a voltage. So we pass a NOP down the pipeline, and that's what gets run for these two extra cycles. So any questions on what happens when we're doing these pipeline bubbles? Yeah?
Are we still faster than a sequential?
So the question is, are we still faster than a sequential? We'll get to that. The answer is usually. So I note that there's another way we could do this stalling, which is equivalent, which is that instead of deciding, oh, I can't cast the instruction down the pipeline in the fetch stage, I could let it go to the code and then say, oh, I'm not going to read the right register values, I'm going to try again next cycle. This requires more logic. We need some way of feeding the decode registers back to themselves and the fetch register and the PC register back to itself too. So this is more complicated to implement, but might be simpler because I can wait longer to figure out, oh gosh, I need to wait. And you might see that too. But it's equivalent in effect to this. It's just that we waited a little longer to detect that we need to stall, which means that we need to do a little more work to keep two instructions waiting rather than just one. So, since we talk about stalling, so here's my add queue processor, fetch, decode, execute, write back, and question I have here is, given these instructions where I have some dependencies which are hazards. So I have this R9, which we need here, and this R11, which we need here, and if I don't do anything, I'm gonna have the wrong values. So if I went to use stalling to fix this problem, how many cycles of stalling do I need? And as a hint to work this out, I recommend writing out what's in what stage like you saw on this slide. And I went the minimum number because, like, obviously if I add 100 cycles of stalling between each instruction, yes, it will work. I'll give you a minute to work it out. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks we need one cycle? Okay, couple, two, three, four, more than four? Okay, anyone want to defend their answer? Yeah.
So our logic was that it takes two non-instructions between successive ads that have the same data currency. And so if you do the first one, there's an intermediate instruction, and then you have another instruction that depends on our ad, so you have one knob there.
Okay, so you're saying that this is distance one,
yeah,
but need two,
yeah,
in order to wait long enough. So that's one knob and okay, so you said two.
Yeah.
Okay, and you said same thing here, that we have distance one and we needed two. Okay, so yeah. Yes, but the observation is that if you add something here, you're adding to the distance for both of them, so you only need one. So a way you can figure this out is by writing out a timeline. So here I've written the cycle number going across, since in the previous picture I had it going down, and where each instruction ends. So I'm saying during cycle zero, our first add queue is in the fetch stage, then in cycle one it's in decode, while the second one is in the fetch stage, and so on. And my observation is that since R9 goes from here to here, that the value that's produced during the write back stage of the first add instruction is needed in time for the decode stage of the add R9 R8. And that means that I need to delay the decode stage long enough that this is a line that goes forward in time. So I can't have, I can't do this, because then I'd have my my line here that would need to go to here, and it's not available in time. And once I've added this one cycle of stalling here, I see that, this second arrow, where I need R11 to go from the second instruction to the fourth one, already lines up. That I get it in write back, I need it in decode, it's already in the right place, I don't have to go backwards in time to send my value, everything's good. And this is the general way I figure things like this out. You try to write out the instructions and you move things over from where they would naturally be until the minimum distance to add the stalling you need, which is that the rule is that the value is produced in write back in this case, and needed to be available in the middle of decode. Produced at the end of write back, you need it in the middle of decode, so I can't shift things over any more to the left, it's not gonna work. So this makes sense. And yes, we have this case where we've sort of paid for two data hazards with one stall, which is great. Not as bad as it could be. Okay, so there was a question earlier about, how much does this help performance? So let's say I measured my processor, and I measured how much I have to stall when I'm using stalling to make sure I don't have hazards. And let's assume that I've assigned each stalling to one instruction, even if it helps out with multiple instructions. So like in that case, I would say one instruction stalls, even though that stall is needed for two instructions to work. And let's say I measured that 1% of the time I need to stall four cycles, an instruction four cycles, 2% I need to install instruction three cycles, 10% I need to install two, 15% I need to install one. So what's the mean cycles per instruction? This is a throughput number throughput, not latency. So like how many instructions that I'm getting done per cycle inverted that I get given these statistics. So someone want to tell me, how would I compute this? So I'm saying a weighted average. Could you be more specific? 1 times 4 plus, so, okay.
Yeah.
And this, okay, so this is great. So note that this is 4 extra cycles. And 0.02 times 3 extra cycles. So you do that plus 1 cycle normally. Because if we're stalling for 1 cycle, we're taking an extra cycle. If we didn't stall at all, every instruction would take 1 cycle as far as throughput is concerned. And so if we compute that, we get our answer there. That we have our 1 that every instruction takes, and that weighted average, 15% of the time we take 1, 10% of the time we take 2 extra, 2% of the time we take 3 extra, and so on, and we get our total time, which is 1.45 cycles per instruction. And this is sort of a throughput number, so this is sort of the average rate at which instructions finish. We look at the average time between instructions, its average is 1.45 cycles. So we had lots of stalling here, sometimes stalling for a long time, and a lot of our instructions stalled. So the question is, like, well, does this mean our processor is better or worse? And of course, it depends on, well, how much did we reduce our cycle time by doing pipelining? So let's say our original cycle time was 1,200 picoseconds, but with pipelining, we managed to get it down to 300. So probably we have 5 pipeline stages, because it's hard to imagine stalling for 4 cycles if you don't. And we have a new cycle time of 300 picoseconds, which means we got a fourth the cycle time with 5 stages, so less than ideal, but pretty good. How much better is our throughput now? So someone want to tell me how I can compute this? How much better our throughput is? Yeah.
So before it was exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's exactly the reasoning. We have 1.45 average cycles per instruction times 300 picoseconds a cycle. So that's the average time per instruction, which ends up being 435 picoseconds, assuming I didn't make a math mistake, versus 1 every 1,200. And we find out that we're 2.76 times faster. So with 5 pipeline stages, this would be way less than ideal. We're like half as fast as you might imagine by saying we made things, you know, we split things into 5 pieces and we're doing 5 things in 5 instructions in parallel. Because we had the cost of uneven splits to pipeline stages, register delays, and the stalling we needed to do in order to deal with hazards. And this is sort of a typical result that we get. It's a lot faster, but it's not nearly the ideal amount faster. And hypothetically, like if these stalling numbers were higher, it could be slower. Okay. So any questions on computing this throughput and things related to that? Okay, so we talked about using stalling and data hazards. We have one other type of hazard, and that's a control hazard. And I should do a correction to this that's minus. And that's that, well, if we have something like a conditional jump, we don't know at the time we're doing the fetch stage what the next instruction is. Do we take the jump or don't we? And we don't know that until we actually compute SF and ZF, which we won't update until we actually get the previous instruction potentially to its execute stage so we can actually compute the new value that we use to set SF and ZF. And we can solve this with stalling. So we can wait, we can have the jump instruction wait in the fetch stage until we know that the value of SF and ZF is available. So we have two cycles we wait for the add queue to update the condition codes. And we fill those cycles with stalling, so we're inserting nops in order to have the condition codes be up to date. And another representation of that is that we, you know, pass the jump through the pipeline and we use it in the execute stage, which is after the op queue happens. And only then do we actually do our next fetch. These are both equivalent. We're both, in both cases, we have two wasted cycles where we have to wait for the values for the conditional jump to be available to know what instruction do we fetch. So this is another hazard. It's called a control hazard because we don't know what instruction to even run. It's not that we don't know the values. It's that we don't know what instruction to run at all. We don't know what instruction to fetch, so we have to stall in this so far until we know what to fetch. So we have one other, So in this case, I'm saying we pass the jump through the pipeline and we send the result of the condition code comparison to the fetch stage when it's available, which is not going to be right away, because we need to wait for that at sub Q in this case. Another case where we need to stall is return, where we don't even know what the possible addresses are because we have to read from the data memory. So, you know, and potentially, in the worst case, the return address was stored in the previous instruction. So we need to wait for that previous instruction to get to the memory stage. We can't read the memory early. And only after we've actually read the address, can we fetch the next instruction. So we have three wasted cycles where we can't do anything. We just need to wait to find out where do we go next. And we need to wait because we can't read the memory yet, and we can't read the memory yet because even if no other instruction is using the memory, maybe it's written in the previous instruction. We need to wait for that. And so we can solve both of these with stalling, like I've shown here. So we're just adding these. This is stalling, where these waitings and these nothings are just, we're inserting nops because we don't know what to do at all. We wouldn't even get the wrong answer. We don't even know what instruction to run, so we're going to run a nop until we find out what instruction to run. So any questions on our stalling cases? Here, yeah. The question is, which stage would the condition code register be? Our textbook's choice is that the condition codes live in the execute stage, which makes sense because that's where we modify them. And okay, so we'll pick up around here next time. So leaving us, we have our pipeline stages. So we have our fetch, which is where we do instruction memory stuff and most PC computation. So we saw with conditional jump and return that we're going to have a few extra cases we need to deal with differently. Like for return, we don't actually get the PC until we get to the memory stage. For conditional jump, we need to deal with the condition codes, which our textbook chooses to do in the execute stage. So we're going to wait till there. And as I said, our textbook choice is that the condition codes happen in the execute stage. And a nice convenient consequence of that is that if we only read and write them in the execute stage, we don't need to reason about data hazards, right? Because instructions go to the execute stage in order. We don't need to worry about reading the condition codes before we write them if we follow that rule. So that's the rule we're going to end up following. And I guess one other minor thing is that I didn't mention about the stat register. We're going to write the stat register in the writeback stage. Why are we going to do that in the writeback stage? Why not earlier? We know it in the fetch stage. We know what value we want to write in the fetch stage. Why wouldn't we write it in the fetch stage? Yeah. Yeah. Yes, because so we don't halt too early. We want halt to not take effect until after, like, the prior instruction wrote to memory or to the registers. And so we need to wait until the very end. Okay. So next time, we're going to look at our hazards we've had, where we previously were stalling to deal with hazards. And we're going to figure out how to improve that in two ways. We're going to introduce something called forwarding, which will deal with most data hazards in a more efficient way. And we're going to introduce something called branch prediction, which will deal with some of the control hazards in a more efficient way.